After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to the Be Here Now Network guest podcast. This series features talks from a myriad of modern spiritual teachers expanding on how we can all live a life in balance. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/guest.
Hey, everybody, I'm Francesca Maxime, and this is Wise Girl, and I'm really happy to really invite what the spirit of Wise Girl is about, inviting your inner wisdom to shine, your inner wise girl or guy. I'm not the wise girl, per se, although some people have accused me of that. But I do have a wise woman joining us today named Rhonda McGee. She is the professor of law, mindfulness, and social justice teacher and advocate at the University of San Francisco. She is an internationally recognized thought and practice leader on integrating mindfulness into higher education, law, and social justice, a fellow of the Mind and Life Institute. She's also a member of the Board of Advisors of the University of Massachusetts Center for Mindfulness and the Board of Directors for the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute. And she can explain more about that if you're not familiar with it, but it's exciting what they do. Professor McGee is the author of numerous articles, including Educating Lawyers to Meditate, The Way of Color Insight, Understanding Race and Law, Effectively Using Mindfulness-Based Color Insight Practices, and a forthcoming book on mindfulness and social justice to be published by Tarcher Pirji, a member of the Penguin Random House Group. Rhonda McGee, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's really a pleasure. And congratulations on, getting that book birthed.
Thank you so much. It's been its own journey. This is my first book, so I'm excited about it and also glad it's progressed to the stage that it has, that it's, you know, getting closer and closer to being released. So I'm excited about it too. Thanks.
Yeah. And I'm sure it will, as we do with the Bodhisattva vow, for the benefit of all beings, right? Anytime one puts that down on paper, it can disseminate the wisdom there. So
may it be so.
Yeah, may it be so. And may we also, as I was mentioning earlier, when we were off camera, my sort of lens is this business of applied mindfulness. How do we integrate mindfulness into our daily lives? How do we integrate mindfulness in our social justice lens? How do we integrate a social justice lens or a collective lens into our individual sort of sometimes myopic and sometimes necessarily so lives and broaden it a little bit? And one of the things that's on the table today is something that's really galvanizing the nation politically right now, and you being a law professor, I thought might want to just share your thoughts about what's happening right now in terms of the Supreme Court.
Thanks for asking, Francesca. Today is a day that we're hearing from the third accuser to bring allegations of some sort of sexual misconduct against the current Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. And so it's quite a day, actually, for those of us who've been at all involved in law. But actually, for Americans generally who've been paying attention to this, it's really a day where it's hard to take in the news that we're hearing. What we're hearing are the kinds of allegations of assault and misconduct and disrespect and harassment that unfortunately are more common than we like to think in many, many women's experiences in the U.S. and around the world. And so that suggests, on the one hand, that while it's particularly sort of shocking, if you will, to have someone at the level of a Supreme Court nominee being alleged to have been involved in these kinds of activities, on the other hand, we shouldn't really be surprised, because there's so much evidence. This is the era of the Me Too movement, but even before that, so much evidence, if we're willing to pay attention, that that these traditional ways that women are vulnerable to being taken advantage of, sexually assaulted, across a spectrum of just some unwanted touching or contact, all the way to the worst, most invasive types of assaults. That spectrum is broad, and we've known that many, many women are vulnerable and have been victimized in some ways at some points in our lives. I am one of those women. And so, again, it's a difficult time to be reminded how prevalent it is, to see just how the system is responding in ways that are very apparently self-protective of the nominee, and to see the nominee and the team around the nominee just really defend and not really open up to investigate what there is to be known about whether or not these allegations have some substance. And so just to see that level of defendedness and unwillingness perhaps to open to what may be known is its own shocking, revelation. And for many, again, for women who have, and not just women, for those of us who have been victimized in any way, to see a person who has the courage to come forward with really nothing to gain by doing so, be met with such resistance in terms of the systemic failure to simply do the work that we've come to expect of people in positions of authority. We expect them simply, at a minimum, to be willing to investigate. And so instead, we're hearing charges of, all kinds of charges against the people who are simply brought these allegations forward. So it's a tough, really tough time on a lot of levels. For me as a woman who happens to have had some experience with being assaulted, and for me as a law professor, having students who are coming to me and people in positions like me with really hard questions about what is going on. I just happened to have sat in and participated in to some extent on a discussion about these charges and the Kavanaugh nomination and the gender justice issues that are coming up just yesterday. So this is, it's a very rich time for me on many, many different levels. And I am just hopeful that one way or another, we as a society will learn something about how to go forward more carefully, more respectfully, with greater commitment to women, to justice for women and for other victims of these types of assaults from here. Hopefully we'll go forward having learned something. But for now, it's a bit challenging.
It is a bit challenging. And I think it's very triggering for a lot of us who have mm-hmm. experienced anything from an unwanted advance to a full out, you know, assault or some repetitive form of that, yeah. as many people have also suffered. But what you bring to the table is inquiry. And what I think is so interesting about particularly Vipassana meditation, but also about the law, is this idea of drilling down to truth, right? Like the slogan of my school was Veritas, right? Truth, right? Mm-hmm. But it was interesting because it was about truth almost as if it were a fixed entity, as opposed to the process of inquiry. Right? So we're really mm-hmm. wanting to look at what is the process of inquiry. And a lot of the uproar that I see right now is that process of inquiry, societally or systemically in many cases, is being prematurely aborted. And so when you're not even engaging in that dialogue to begin the path and first step of process and inquiry, then you cannot actually see through to fruition what the true outcome would be and do what the Buddha said, which is get rid of our ignorance and delusional thinking and see what's really here.
Exactly. Exactly. That unwillingness to really inquire and to accept what there is to be seen, to see and then accept what there is to be seen, is just profoundly disturbing, actually, to me. And also not entirely surprising, because what we're really seeing are the ways that, on the one hand, we have these systems and processes that in some ways have been the envy of many people around the world, many countries that don't have the kinds of commitments to rule of law, to a doctrine of equality, due process, these sorts of norms, the commitments to investigating truth, investigating claims, and following the truth where it might lead, whether in a formal court of law situation or just in the everyday way that we translate those commitments to the projects in our general civic life, right, or work world. So we tend to be proud of America for the way in which we have, over many, many decades, over our history, fought to expand the reach and application of these commitments so that everybody is included in their protections. And to see, though, that we still have evidence that despite the fact we have these promises and these systems and commitments on the one hand, we also have entrenched systems of power, entrenched systems of cultural coding and different ways that we systemically privilege certain people, certain groups, certain types of people, and disadvantage in systemic and in personal, interpersonal and systemic ways other people. And so I think that's what we're seeing here. You know, the system is only as effective as the culture is. Actually, and we often don't realize how much it is the case that whatever happens in law and policy arises out of commitments that are really operating at the ground of the level of the culture itself. And so, to the degree the culture, our culture, has not fully embraced the ongoing call to provide real justice and real equality for everybody, including women, we're not going to see that in the system. If the culture is lagging and confused and embattled and polarized about the roles of women, about our entitlement to full access and opportunity, then of course you're going to see law and policymakers similarly conflicted. And in some instance, we're seeing even more because there are, again, legacies of entrenched patterns by which we've traditionally said men are the ones we trust with government and men are the ones we trust in law. And so therefore, we have this kind of appalling scenario of such a widespread disparity between in terms of the gender dimensions of what is happening, playing out on the legal stage and the political stage right now, the disproportionate representation of white men relative to all other sorts, white, you know, cisgendered men, at least publicly heterosexual, so heteronormativity. There is a lot that just tells us how entrenched those patterns are. And they are, you know, the system is not a match if our culture hasn't unpacked and truly created a world where everybody is entitled to all the protections that our system might afford. So here we are.
Right. And so here we are. And, you know, I'm in New York City. I know you're on the West Coast, but, you know, the UN is convening. And it was even just yesterday that the current leader of our nation, you know, addressed the UN and, you know, really had quite a lot to say about what he didn't feel other entities, countries were doing well. And I do think that what you're talking about is systemic, right? And so there's multiple levels. There's sort of the macro level, the meso level, the micro level. Mm-hmm. And the macro level, the systemic piece, I think is sort of like when you're a fish in water, you don't really realize it. You don't really think so much about it. We breathe air, we breathe oxygen. We don't think about it all that much mm-hmm. until we don't have it. If you have asthma, you think about it. If your mm-hmm. air is polluted, you think about it. But otherwise, you don't really mm-hmm. think about it. So mm-hmm. it's just there. And to the degree that, I'll name it, patriarchy is present and systemically part of the fabric of the way in which we have structured our society, which really is nothing more, I don't think, than power over as opposed to power with, right? Mm-hmm. Which is what you're mm-hmm. talking about. That's sort mm-hmm. of the, you know, as Gloria Steinem said, we're, you know, we're linked, we're not ranked. It's kind mm-hmm. of it in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, more for you means less for me. So I need to get mine, and we're in this constant race. And applying this to mindfulness and applying this to, you know, sort of looking at things through this mindful lens or how mindfulness can inform us at that micro level to then help perhaps change and shift to things like the culture that you're talking about to then help us start planting seeds at the root and the ground level so that we can start to decalcify mm-hmm. some of the systemic things like sexism or ableism or racism mm-hmm. and, you know, you can add your ism, I think is really important because when people can start to ground in their individual looking at what's here, they can actually turn to what's challenging about what's systemically here also.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so well said. It's one of the reasons why I'm drawn to mindfulness as a modality for supporting work in the world is that it really, I have personally found no better set of tools for doing just what you just described, for preparing ourselves to starting with our own selves, seeing more clearly what, again, there is to be seen. So really coming into some kind of more authoritative, if you will, self-authoring relationship with who we are, understanding the agency we have and the role we play in creating a world that works better for everyone. And so mindfulness for me certainly is a key, if not the key, frankly, to engaging in my own ways with what might keep me stuck in not seeing opportunities that are available for me to help make a positive difference, starting with myself, for myself, but extending that out to others. And so there's definitely a way in which mindfulness for me is about developing a right relationship with myself. It's ultimately in about relationality as it applies in every domain of our experience. But certainly that encompasses how it is that we relate to our own sense of self and what that means for how we interact with others. So that's one piece of it, just, you know, there's a lot to be said there, and we could stay there, just how it is that mindfulness supports us in seeing ourselves in ways that support change in the world, in ways that support more effective, liberatory engagement with others. And that by itself, again, there's a profound set of underlying kind of commitments that support that piece. And ultimately, depending on how one pursues mindfulness and, you know, to what extent one pursues not just the basic practices of sitting and becoming more aware of one's thoughts, emotions, sensations, becoming more sort of present to all of that which arises as we move about the world and as in these packages we call our separate bodies. The more we kind of are present to what it means to really be alive, the more all kinds of insights can arise about the inherent interconnections we are all living through and making manifest. And for many of us, it can lead to a different way of being with the sense of the self that is fundamentally committed to, as much as possible, doing no harm. But again, as we all know, just that intention to do no harm doesn't mean, in fact, we won't. And so it's about a deeper commitment to being constantly engaged in the work of repair to the degree we need to be, to minimize, again, the harm that we will do inevitably as human beings in a world together. And so there are just so many ways that I think, again, as we look at just what it means to kind of from the place of our relative experience, the embodiments that we, you know, that we've been blessed to be able to inhabit in the world. From this place of, you know, being the cisgendered female, racialized Black, you know, in America at this time, didn't choose these things, but this is what showed up, right, in my own experience. And we each, you know, have that same kind of almost absurd, right, experience that we just arrived on in a planet with a family, right, with a history, and yet we inhabit it. We come to appreciate, we come to attach, and find a sense of value and meaning and purpose and all of those things. But mindfulness can ultimately help us hold our story, our bit, our piece, our position, our sort of piece of the cloth, if you will, with a certain kind of humility, a certain kind of, you know, a humility that recognizes it's just a piece in a huge mosaic. We'll never fully understand this mystery that we're a part of. So there's a kind of humility that comes with that. There's also a sort of sense of awe that comes with it, like, and grace and gratitude that we do have these moments of life together to do the best we can with the time that we have. There's just so many ways then that, depending on how deep I would say that we go with our mindfulness practice, we can be supported in bringing about deeper and deeper transformations, deeper and deeper changes on the ground that may ultimately lead to a different world, a different way of being with one another. I don't think these things necessarily happen overnight, either in ourselves, interpersonally or systemically. And they may not happen in ways that we ever get to see, you know, actually apprehend. And at the same time, I I believe, I trust, there's evidence in my own experience that change is already happening, that these practices do bring about changes. So there's some reason for hope, despite all of the challenges that we're in.
Yeah, no, I love all of what you're saying, especially our relationality and our interdependence and you know, sort of that, again, going back to process and, you know, not specific to content or fixed states or rigidity, that we're really always sort of evolving, or hopefully evolving, that we're at least always shifting in some way. And that everything is sort of causal and, you know, dependent, and the ways in which we set the GPS, if you will, of our lives is going to be, if not fixed on a set destination, it's the compass, I should say, less the GPS, that we're orienting ourselves towards something, I think, once we open to mindfulness, once we open to this process, that is much more of a commitment to, as I call it, the persistence, as opposed to the resistance, for example. Mm-hmm. It is not defining so much as the anti, but what are we for?
Exactly.
Or if we're for love, or if we're for connection, or if we're for happiness, then how do we go about that? And, you know, your work about, we can talk more about, you know, some of the pieces that you've included in your book, and also in some of the articles that you've written, and understanding race and law effectively, because I think, you know, one of the sort of evolutions in my own personal practice has gone from my personal practice, you know, sort of an understanding of who am I really? What am I about? How did I get here? All the things you said, what's my positionality within the context? Where am I privileged? Where am I not? You know, all of these different things. And then how do I use that? But being grounded in a sense of, as one of my teachers says, inner nobility and dignity, and then moving forward outside to being able to affect change. When you're talking about racism, when you're talking about the law, when you're talking about what we're seeing now, not only in this country, but also in Europe and in other places, and how that sort of sense of contraction or myopia or limitation can be sort of, you know, neurophysiologically, we can look at the brain and the fear response and all that kind of stuff, as opposed to bringing the prefrontal cortex online that mindfulness can do and all of those beautiful things that we know now. But how can we use some of these practices or our awareness in this way? And how can we maybe reimagine, given the way that this country was founded legally, when you're looking at the history of Native Americans, the history of Black Americans, how can we begin to take some ownership and begin that process of repair if we are in this process of waking ourselves?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, there's so many different ways to do it. There's so many different doorways into the processes by which we might repair, heal, regenerate, rebuild, start over. I think a really important piece has to do with recognizing what it really means to interbe or to live in interdependence. Again, part of what the law has contributed to our consciousness is a kind of a false consciousness around the degree to which we are these separate, atomized, isolated entities, right? I mean, the law, of course, on the one hand, evolved this great notion of individual rights, which was very important historically to support a kind of a movement in the direction of liberating individuals, human beings, from oppressed structures, whether it be from feudalism, enslavement, the kind of oppression of sort of religiosity and organized religion over individuals. So there's a way in which the idea of individual rights that is a legacy of the Enlightenment period and provided a foundation for the evolution of what we call constitutionalism. I mean, all of this is really rich and profound and certainly has provided a kind of a ground level of you know, sort of concepts to support the articulation of pathways toward freedom for that many, again, many people around the world have grasped onto from that. The human rights revolution evolved in the middle of the last century. So this notion of rights tied to individual human dignity, really, really profound and important. The question that I think should occupy those of us who have been privileged to be the beneficiaries of that discourse and those ways of organizing our political economy, the question we should be thinking about in the 21st century is, to what extent have we kind of oversubscribed to the idea of individualism? Have we moved into this sort of hyper-individualism that makes it very, very, very hard to apprehend interconnectedness, interdependence, interrelational responsibility, and all that might flow from that in terms of, put it simply, how we are with one another, you know, what we owe to one another. I'm just recently reminded of a comment that someone made and has shared in the social media realm about how 90% of mindfulness could be summarized as just good manners. I'm not sure I would go that far exactly, but the idea being that, somehow along the way, with all of this sort of good information about our rights and good grounding in this sort of philosophy of what we call liberalism, the small L, liberal legal thought, everything that goes with it around rights and rule of law, somehow we've missed a deep understanding of what it means to just be well with one another. We've been so defendant, so caught up in adversarial ways of, as you alluded to before, like ensuring that our piece of the pie is, not being compromised by somebody else, and making sure that our identity group, ourselves, our familiars, are protected and taken care of, that we've lost, I think, a lot along the way, with regard to just what it means to effectively commune together, to be together in community, to have a sense of the we. So I do think that part of what mindfulness can do as we sort of move from that, the what arises in personal practice and open up to that profound relationality that really is a gift of mindfulness practice for many of us, the profound sense that we're always inherently a part of something larger than ourselves. The very breath that we breathe, we didn't create. And without it, in short order, we wouldn't be here. The water we need to sustain ourselves, we don't create. Again, just to be profoundly present to that is a waking up to the reality that we're literally constantly interdependent. And so from there, to be aware of the truth of the fact that there is this sort of intersubjective space that is alive, that arises between you and I, or those of us in a room together, those of us in experiencing this conversation together across the miles and through technology. There is a generative field that arises when human beings connect. It's more profoundly so, I believe, when we're in person, but this technology helps support it happening even when we are not. And we don't have language really in the liberal legal discourse for really acknowledging and honoring the we space. And we're gonna need that, I think, if we're gonna really survive a period of so many challenges to the old ways, the world that we've built up through individual rights discourse, right? Which includes a world, for example, that has global warming as a legacy, a world that has this constant battle between the sexes as a legacy. We have got to find another way. And I do think that these sort of ways of being mindful that apprehend the whole, that apprehend communal and intersubjective awareness building, those are keys, I think, to helping build, but also just make us more aware of the power the profound power that is right here in us and between us, through which we can know more profoundly what there is to be known, but also create what is calling forth from us if we're to survive, I think, as a human, as a race, into the next century.
Yeah, no, I really love all of your, you're saying, because it's not sustainable, right? What we're doing to our planet or to one another. And it's not, you can't keep extracting without planting, you know? So there has to be this more generative, as you say, field. And you know, relationality does in fact have that inherent in it, right? It's building through these shared energies and moving upward and sort of spiraling sort of in a way out. It's not... Right. You know, this samsaric cyclical, you know, repeated circle necessarily, although it might be two steps forward and one step back. What I really hear what you're saying is, you know, unfortunately, we've kind of moved somehow into a transactional relationality as opposed to a heart relationality that, you know, especially as mammals, is really who we are and what we're about, as you were talking about. We're, you know, we couldn't have existed on our own as babies. And it also reminds me that kind of what you're touching in on when we talk about relationality is what in some circles might be called the feminine, or, you know, the sort of that other earthier kind of principle. And one of my teachers says that, you know, in our society, we idealize the feminine in principle, but we devalue it in fact. And so in some ways, you know, we have a lot of ideas about what it should be or how we talk about it or think about it. But in fact, as you were starting the conversation by saying, it's not really, really there. It's not really supported by, we don't even have the Equal Rights Amendment and constitutionality. You know, women don't have equal rights in this country as we speak.
Right. Yes. Well, yeah. And so also, you know, what's coming up for me too is this, What we've inherited is this notion of a binary around feminine and masculine, which is also not sustainable, and also caught being called into question every day in so many different ways, whether it be from the sort of rise in the naming of gender fluid ways of expressing ourselves as individuals on the one hand, but also just in the ways that we're opening up to what it means to invite everybody to this conversation about what relationality really is, and to name more richly the degree to which, whether we are, in terms of our conventional understanding, male or female, or see ourselves as partaking of the feminine or not, it's part of who we all are. There's a part of every human being. Each of us having been born of a woman, frankly, that has this inherent kind of relational aspect and dimension. And yet there is something to the ways in which we've shaped the so-called feminine and masculine and embodied it in these sort of binary ways that really, I think, mindfulness can also help us turn more rightly and richly too. I do think that much of the work that I do is about seeking to create spaces where we can turn to turn toward these deep and difficult, in many, many ways, examination and exploration of the way we inhabit identity, whether it be around race, gender, sex orientation, the intersections of these with all the other sorts of different ways we identify ourselves or are identified by others, which vary so much depending on where we are in a particular time and place, right? Culture, nation, right? So many different variables. And the sociologist in me is aware of that, that, you know, there are certain things that look pretty persistent across cultures. Identity around gender and age, the sociologist will say, no matter where you are in the world, there's some way in which we're making something of age and gender almost, you know, almost universally, let's just say. But then when it comes to these other ways, the terms that we use may vary so much. Some cultures have a conversation about race that's kind of particularly important in that culture. For some cultures, something else may be more so, more to the fore. Maybe it's religion, maybe it's lineage in a certain way. So each of us as human beings, we're again embedded in time and place. And so there is this tension in mindfulness communities often between the universal experience of humanity and the embodiment, right? The brain, body, the universalities of that. And on the one hand, and the particular differentiations that we know to be a part of our lived experience. And so for me, my work has really been drawn towards helping expand the sense that it's not either universal or particular. It's not particular evolved to universal. It's all part of the great mystery of what it means to be alive, different doorways in. We go in through the door of particular experience, me listening to your story, you listening to mine. And through that kind of experience in real time, the profoundness of our, again, interconnectedness, oneness, similarities in our differences. So I think, you know, to take just that part of the work that I do that is about helping create greater spaciousness and capacity building around doing identity work, let's say, changing some of the narratives and some of the traditional ways we think about identity, which to me is we're just scratching the surface with this. We're just beginning to figure out how to turn toward these aspects of ourselves in a way that apprehends the way the world is constructed today. Like, you know, there is a world in which something called gender is operating, something called race is operating. It doesn't, none of us have any real justice to pretend these things aren't happening. But at the same time, we can over-construct and over-reify, if you will, make too fixed these notions of these concepts of around identity. So having that supple capacity to deal with the kind of contradictions, if you will, the paradoxes, there is and isn't something called race that's relevant in my everyday experience. There is and is and isn't something called gender that I can relate to in a certain kind of way. That sort of radical openness and also a certain kind of adeptness with kind of using language as necessary to try to describe and point toward, as the Buddhists will say, something that's relevant in experience, but while recognizing all the while that we're only ever able to point toward the language itself, if we kind of try to attach and fix it too tightly, is its own new constraint. And so that's where mindfulness to me is just this radical kind of opening up of capacity to sit in big, relationship with what is. And again, when it comes to doing that around identity, I think we're just beginning. And there's a lot of tension between the kind of field of folk who talk about identity, like who are identity specialists, if you will, just social justice advocates on one hand, who haven't embraced a mindful way of holding all of that, right? So bringing mindfulness to that conversation, but on the other hand, bringing the social justice language into the mindfulness conversation, right? So there's mutuality that needs to be engaged in and lots of good work to be done. But we're just beginning. I'm in it, you know, for forever. I honestly believe that it's not about this being side and ancillary to mindfulness. This is mindfulness. This is a part, a profoundly an aspect of experience in this body, in this life, this very life. And so for me, this is just a kind of another doorway into this deep, rich path that we call mindfulness in the world, mindfulness applied.
Yeah, no, I love that. Thank you, Rhonda. And you know, I often think of it as the both and not the either or. Exactly. You know, it's just, it's really, again, either creating or, you know, whatever, enough space so that more can be held. And, you know, and as you start to do that, you know, there's that whole thing about the salt in the teacup, yuck. The salt in the bathtub or in the lake, doesn't matter, you know? So meaning that you can taste it when it's too small and too narrow, but then you can't when there's more space around it. We're winding down with time, but I do think though that it's worth noting that, you know, Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams says this a lot, you know, none of us are free until we're all free. And, you know, she, I think, is doing this work very much so front and center also, and really appealing on the white or privileged communities to begin doing particular education around the history of race in this country, how we were founded, how we got here, in order to then be able to have a more informed dialogue with understanding how this applies to not only our own personal mindfulness practice, but then informing how we comport ourselves going forward.
Absolutely.
So could you just maybe touch on that before we close?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, again, I have used the concept of the you know, in mindfulness, we talk about being present to the moments of our lives in a certain kind of way. And for me here, this is an opportunity to reflect on what we mean by the moment. And to me, it's this long, broad, and deep moment that includes our history, always, it's always in us. And it's an invitation to kind of, for all of us to look at how we got here as part of what it means to be here. In other words, right, this idea of mindfulness is just being about like this moment, this breath, can lead to a kind of myopic, overly narrow exploration of what is there to be seen. And I, like Reverend Angel, often implore, right, invite, support a way of holding the now that recognizes its deep rootedness in what we conventionally call the past. But how past is it if in this very moment, we engage with each other in ways that bear the marks of what we know about the history of slavery, the history of female subjugation to men in this country and around the world. How past is it, right? If we, as we go out, I go out, you know, in my environment here in San Francisco, and I see patterns of immigration and employment that bear the mark of the patterns of migration, forced migration, and immigration for the purposes of survival across the southern border, but also from Africa being brought here. In other words, the patterns, the hierarchies that we see today bear every bit the mark and the stamp of the so-called histories that we're talking about. And so there's a way in which I think mindfulness work definitely calls upon whites who have often, because of their experience in the majority, been supported and being kind of blind to the way in which this, these histories are still very relevant to their now, right? Or have a particular set of projects, has some particular work to do to become more aware of how it is that history is right here in the present. And I think there can be some kind of consternation around that, because I think part of whiteness has been the construction around avoiding turning toward that history. Part of what it means to be white is to avoid not just the history, but any kind of pain associated with it, any kind of sense of suffering or responsibility associated with it. That's what it has meant to be white, is to be fully comfortable saying that was then and this is now. I just learned that one of my teachers, Jon Kabat-Zinn, his grandparents, I believe it was, came to this country with a name that that was truncated to Kabat, right? A name that bore every bit the mark of their heritage in Europe, that would have marked him as more, his family and his lineage as more of an outsider than was the case when they truncated that name to Kabat. I'm going to go and look at that articulation so that I can name the longer name when I have a conversation with him, which I will soon, actually, at the New York Wisdom 2.0 event that's coming up October 23rd or 22nd or so. We're going to be together in conversation with Anderson Cooper. I'm very much looking forward to this. But people who are not able to come to New York can participate with us via online. You just access to the conversation. But we will be talking about mindfulness and race. And one of the things that I'll hopefully have a chance to talk with him about before, during, or after, as we are friends in this journey, really is, you know, what is it? What is the work of whites to really look at their heritage, their immigration stories? What was given up in the way of deep relationship to subcultures that did not know themselves as white in order to become white in this country? And the redemptive value that is yet to be unraveled or opened up, that can come from just really looking with humility at all of that history and its legacies today. So yes, I do believe that there is a profound set of ways that mindfully engaging with whiteness, and that is something that is a project has particular meaning for people who are racialized white. But actually, if you grow up in a white supremacist world, which we all do, that means you're growing up, if you're deemed a success on any level, being invited to have some relationship and some orientation toward whiteness. And I know something about that myself. So it's a project for all of us to really look at how whiteness has impacted all of us. Again, that's different for each of us, but we have something to learn about that inquiry if we have been raised and acculturated in a white supremacist world. And that's also true for gender and sex orientation and all of those dominant, if you will, identities. What have we learned about maleness? All of us, no matter what our gender expression, that we have in some ways accommodated, traded, helped make hegemonic in our societies. What have we learned about heteronormativity? That regardless of our own gender or sex orientation expression, we in some ways have accommodated and made part of the hegemony, like the power structure in our society. We are all in this or wouldn't be so deeply entrenched. And so that to me is the really challenging invitation of mindfulness for all of us to create spaces where we ongoingly interrogate the ways that we contribute to the maintenance of these hierarchies. Because we, again, I don't think we'd be where we are if we didn't have some work to do in those areas, all of us.
Rhonda, I love what you've said and shared, and Wisdom 2.0 is coming up in New York. I was there last year, I'll be there again. Yay. I invite all the folks, as you said, to go and check that out online if you're not going to be in New York, October 21st and 2nd, I think you mentioned. And also, you know, the work that you do, I'll put up all of your information as well, so people can learn more about you. And of course, when your book comes out, I'm hoping that people will snap it up and digest it. And the last piece is just to mention that to do that kind of work, at least around race, I know I found that there's a group in DC called whiteawake.org. Mm-hmm. That does that kind of work around race, perhaps not particularly around the gender or the orientation pieces, but we can start where we are around this racial piece. And I would like to just give them a shout out to support that also, because a lot of folks who are white identified say, where do I start? I don't know. I thought I learned this in school. And I'm like, I did too. I thought I did too until I realized that I really didn't.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're right. Wide Awake. Surge, Standing Up for Racial Justice, is an organization. I don't know how much they're bringing mindfulness in, but I think in some of their local chapters they are. The book that I'm writing does create practices that support this work as well. So, you know, Ruth King's book, I know she's been one of your guests as well. There are, if we're interested, there are many resources, many more resources out there than used to be, and there will be more coming forward. So please stay tuned, stay connected. We're in it together.
Beautiful. Rhonda, I will let you go because you certainly have a lot of things to attend to, and I look forward to seeing you in October in New York City. Safe travels to you, and thanks again for your time and for being here on Wise Girl.
Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure and an honor.
Take good care.
You too.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.